In other news.
To determine why and how the towers collapsed.
Kind of scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. In May of 2019, the Staten Island Borough President James Otto announced the creation of the Council on Boys and Men, becoming the first government agency to address the alarming risk factors to American males. Being the only media present revealed another crisis. The social climate for American males is unfriendly, ideological, and warped by discriminating gatekeepers. Author Dr. Warren Farrell was among the speakers. His recently published book titled The Boy Crisis, Why Our Boys Are Struggling and What We Can Do About It, was the blueprint for this government council. In 2016, past guest Christina Hoff Summers, former philosophy professor and author of The War Against Boys, on this show exposed some of the research by renowned feminist Carol Gilligan as statistically false, yet it was adopted by the U.S. Department of Education. Since the late 90s, this research had been the foundation for the projected image of female students as the oppressed and male students as predators or the oppressors. The Boy Crisis expounds on data collected from generations of men growing up without fathers. The statistics on employment, suicide rates, incarceration, mental health, and higher education reveal a silent war waged against the expendable male. Dr. Warren Farrell is an educator, activist, and author of 7 books on men and women's issues. His books include The Myth of Male Power, Women Can't Hear What Men Don't Say, Does Feminism Discriminate Against Men, and Why Men Are the Way They Are. Dr. Farrell, welcome back to Another News.
I'm looking forward to it. I enjoyed our last interview together on the Why Men Are the Way They Are book.
Well, you begin in your book, The Boy Crisis, by reviewing related mental health issues and the disproportionate number of men in prison. Would you please talk about the racial and sexist issues within the prison industry that isn't publicly discussed very often?
Yes, I think, well, most people have a sense that most people who are in prison are men, and maybe they don't realize that 93% of the people who are in prison are men. So that's a bit of a surprise. And one of the reasons we don't care as much about that is because a high percentage of those prisoners are African American, and we tend not to sort of focus a great deal of attention or empathy or on African Americans when they're in a difficult situation. It's a little bit like with AIDS. We didn't really care a great deal about it until it affected the heterosexual community. So our biases tend to come out with how much resources we put into preventing something from happening. And then what very few people realize about the 93% men is that more than 90% of those men are dad-deprived men and boys and young men. And this is the real surprise that I came across when, I started doing the research for the Boy Crisis about, 15 years ago, and in some ways even longer ago than that, since I've been studying males and females, trying to engage myself in the hopeless activity of getting men and women to understand each other for about 50 years now, and which is a good part of my life. And as I looked at all 56 of the largest developed countries that were, I found that in all 56 of them, there were boys were falling significantly behind girls in almost every single subject, and particularly reading and writing, which are the two biggest predictors of success. And that sort of made me wonder, what was happening with boys. And I started seeing that in the key was developed countries, that in the developed countries, there was enough mastery of survival that the society began to allow itself permission for divorces and allow itself permission to have women be able to raise children without the involvement of fathers or raise them by themselves. And then I found that as I looked further, that the boys that were having, that I would call being part of the boy crisis, the boys that were part of the boy crisis were boys who from divorced families who had lost contact or who had minimum contact, like, you know, once every other weekend and once on Wednesday with their dads. Those boys were having problems. The other group of boys that were having problems were boys that were raised predominantly by single mothers that had minimal or no contact with their dads. And I came to call this group of boys dad-deprived boys. And prisoners, back to your original question, prisoners were are almost all dad-deprived boys. And so I began to see and have empathy for how these boys were hurt. And I began to see this, you know, at first in 2004 when I ran for governor of California and started speaking to some of the prison populations and got a hint of this and, you know, saw how the prisoners who were fathers wanted to be back raising their children now that they knew that they had value to their children and that they weren't just another piece of toxicity that would be back in their children's homes, but they wanted to prevent their children from making the mistakes that they made. And when they saw that the data showed that, in fact, the involvement of the biological father was important, it gave them a new sense of, like, oh, maybe I do have a purpose here on Earth. Maybe I can be of value. I therefore want to get out of prison. I want to go back. I want to be a force for my family, not repeating the mistakes that I made, my children not repeating those mistakes. And so that's, I think, that was my big lesson from the prison population. But then I saw that the prison population was very similar to two other populations in terms of dad deprivation. One was that the mass shooters, about 90% of the mass shooters post-Columbine, were dad-deprived boys. And also saw that the ISIS recruits were dad-deprived boys, and the smaller percentage of ISIS recruits that were girls or women were dad-deprived girls or women. So this dad deprivation, the power of it, just in these three areas, you know, really struck me very powerfully. And then I found that these were just three of 70 different areas, such as suicide and depression and doing badly in school. These were all results of, or at least highly connected to, dad deprivation.
And those statistics you examine in the beginning of the book regarding employment, suicide rate, incarceration, mental health, and higher education, they point to a silent war being waged against the American male.
Yes, there really is. And there's so much we could do about it that would help everybody. And, you know, just understanding that I was on the board of directors of the National Organization for Women, as you know, in New York City. And so I care a great deal about the future of women as well. And I think we've been doing, the feminist movement has helped us do a really outstanding job in terms of expanding women's options. But in the process of doing that, the feminist movement often painted men as the enemy, as the oppressor, as the patriarch, as the person who earns more than women do, and therefore that they have a system rigged in their benefit. And this has misunderstood so many things, including the fact that, dads earn more money than women do because men don't earn more money than women. Dads earn more money than moms do. And dads earn more money than moms do because when there are children, dads give up jobs that they like more, like being a teacher, to do jobs that pay more money, like being a superintendent of schools or a principal, or quitting education altogether and selling insurance, for example, or working for some technology company or becoming an engineer, whether or not they like to do that, because they recognize once children come that their primary obligation is not to do things that fulfill themselves, but that create more options and opportunities for their children. And so we are missing so many of these things, and therefore we're missing so much of what we can do about it. For example, in schools, we really need to have about 50% male teachers, because when a boy goes from a female-only home to a female-only school system, he becomes very vulnerable to a gang leader giving him structure and reputation and acknowledgement, or alternatively a drug dealer giving him structure, reputation, and acknowledgement, and he wants something to lead him. And when he's not led by his biological dad, he's also vulnerable to being led by somebody that will channel his testosterone in a much more destructive, not constructive direction.
And here we are in 2019, yet that sloganeering has yet to be fully clarified in the public consciousness.
This really speaks to our unconscious. You have people even today like Kamala Harris saying that men earn more money than women do for the same work, and that's not even debatable. But when in fact, you know, she's a very brilliant woman, if she doesn't know that, that's not only debatable but not accurate, that's very sad. But it is difficult to respond to that because she can say that and 99% of her constituency will say, well, yes, of course. And most of the people listening right now will say, well, wait a minute, this guy must be crazy. Men do earn more than women do for the same work. We all know that. We've been hearing that for years. And so, but to respond to that, I can't just give a sentence or two on a radio show. I had to do 9 years worth of research looking at whether, in fact, men do earn more money than women do for the same work. And I found a number of fascinating things, one of which was the fact that this has been a book called Why Men Earn More and What Women Can Do About It. And the real important part is what women can do about it, because women don't have to be victims of a process that's a myth. There's 25 things that women can do to earn as much or more than men do. And you can see this quickly in a couple of statistics. One is that women who have never been married and never had children, they earn 17% more than men who have never been married and never have children. Women earning more than men when they've never been married and never had children, earning more than their male counterparts, been true since the 1970s. And it's certainly even more true today. And the reason for that is that when women have never been married and never had children, they focus on their careers. When men have never been married and never have children, they focus on some combination of their careers and doing careers that they want to do, fulfilling careers. Fulfilling careers, as a rule, pay less. Like, you know, education pays less, in part because many people compete to be teachers and educators because it feels really good to help other people. Men who want to be a musician or an artist or a writer tend to give that up when they know they're going to have children because, as a rule, the chances are words like starving artist are quite common, and it's hard to be a starving dad because you then have the responsibility of helping your children earn more. So that's one way of looking at that. The other way of looking at that is to see that we hear statistics like, well, you know, Dr. Farrell, he's got to be wrong because I just saw a headline saying that male doctors earn more than female doctors, and that headline is accurate. Doesn't that prove me wrong? And actually, it doesn't, because here's what happens. Male doctors do earn more than female doctors, not nearly like a dollar to each 80 cents, but they earn more because male doctors are more likely to be cardiologists and surgeons, and female doctors are more likely to be general practitioners. So if you control for just the general practitioners or just the surgeons, then you have an enormous reduction in the pay gap between men and women. But it still is a few cents, and it still is in favor of men. But if you then control further and say, okay, let's control for the number of hours that they work, the number of years that they've been in the profession, the number of advanced degrees they have, their professions, where they have their degrees from, whether they work for an HMO or whether they work in a private practice, and if they work in a private practice, how many days and hours per week do they work? When you control for those variables, it is the females who earn slightly more than the males in most professions when you control for all those types of variables. And that's what I did in the Why Men Earn More book. And it really helps people. It helps people not understand that, because if you believe that men get paid even one penny more than women do for the same work, same time, same circumstances, etc., that is something I would protest as my former feminist self, because I don't have any interest in living in a world where either sex has the experience of being undervalued. One of the things I said in Why Men Earn More is that, you know, if women do the same work for 79 cents and it costs an employer a dollar for the man to do the same work, A, who would hire a man? And B, if they, let's say the person that would hire a man is a sexist who has no appreciation of women, et cetera, well, he would be punished by going out of business faster than the person who hired all women to do the same job. And so one of the wonderful things about capitalism is that it punishes people who discriminate by having them hire people who are less competent, who just fulfill their biases.
Dr. Farrell, you talk about some intrinsic differences between the mother and father when it pertains to horseplay and teasing of the son by the father. A misunderstanding from the mother could unravel the marriage and pit the children against the father. Would you please talk about the importance and nuance of dad's roughhousing with his children and how that's not always properly communicated to the mother?
Yes, it's almost, you know, almost never properly communicated to the mothers, and mothers can't hear what dads don't say. But it's, when I did the research for the boy crisis, one of the things I found was that there are about 9 differences in what I came to call dad-style parenting versus mom-style parenting. And before I give an example of that with the roughhousing, let me make it clear that the children that do the best don't have just dad-style parenting or just mom-style parenting. They have a dialogue between the mother and father that results in what I call checks and balance parenting. The mother is warning that the child shouldn't climb the tree too high, lest the child gets hurt. The dad is saying, oh, let the kids climb the tree, and then they negotiate a part of the tree to climb that's safer, and the father being out there to cushion any fall, for example. And so that checks and balance parenting usually leads to the child getting the best of safety and the best of risk-taking. So I'll give a much more powerful example through roughhousing. So typically speaking, dad-style parenting will involve much more roughhousing than mom-style parenting, and understand that this can sometimes reverse, and the mom can do the roughhousing, and the dad can be cautious, but it's rare. So the dad is, let's say, saying, okay, kids, it's wrestling time, clap your hand, and he goes, throws the 3 kids on the couch, and, you know, and the job, all right, your job is, the 3 of you, to try to pin me down before I pin all 3 of you down together. And mom is going, I feel like I have just one more child to monitor here. But she says, you know, I don't want to be too interfering, and they're having fun. And so, you know, I'll trust that he has some responsibility. But I just fear in the back of my mind, my intuition tells me that, you know, sooner or later, somebody's going to get hurt. Somebody's going to end up crying. I just feel that in my bones. And she's only about 99.9% likely to be right. And when she is right, she feels like, my goodness, then she feels guilty. Like, you know, I knew that. I should have interfered sooner. I didn't protect my child enough. Next time I'll make sure that this doesn't happen, and I'll protect them proactively rather than just, you know, sit back and let the dad, you know, take rein and be irresponsible like this. But here is what is happening, and that dads never explain, and as I said, moms can't hear what dads don't say, and dads can't hear it because they can't read in almost any magazine that's for parents the data behind why roughhousing, which I'll explain in a moment, leads to children having more empathy, which is so counterintuitive. If a dad said, you know, I want to roughhouse with the children because this will teach them empathy, everyone would think he was crazy, and I'll explain in a moment why he's not and why the data shows that. Or alternatively, he says, I need to teach them the difference between being assertive versus being aggressive. It would be, well, wait a minute, roughhousing just seems like it's aggressive, not assertive. So here's what is really going on. I'll deconstruct the roughhousing. So the children jump back on the dad's back, and they try to pin him down, but in the process of being so excited and wanting to be the number one pitter downer, let's say Jimmy pokes his elbow in Susie's face. And so dad sees that and says, whoa, and Susie starts crying, and that's what mom sees that upsets her. And so dad says, Jimmy, you can't poke your elbow in Susie's face. You can do leverage. You can fake her out. You can move your body this way and to have that leverage. You can fake with your eyes, but you can't poke your elbow in her face. Okay, Dad. I got it. So now the father returns to the roughhousing. Mom is thinking, well, wait a minute, didn't you learn your lesson? You saw that the roughhousing led to crying, but dad wants to give the children a chance to change their behavior. Now Jimmy knows something different that he didn't know before, which is that if I don't pay attention to my sister's needs to not have my elbow in her face, I'll lose something I want to have, which is the roughhousing, but maybe I won't. Maybe dad just says that, like mom says a lot of things and then she doesn't follow through with them and she just warns us again. So maybe dad's just not going to be that way. So in the excitement of trying to pin down dad again the second time, Jimmy still pushes Susie aside too much, and Dad stops the roughhousing if he's a good dad, and says, "Okay, no more roughhousing tonight." "Oh, Daddy, I'm so sorry. We won't do that again. Let's try again, Dad." "Nope, I said that was not to happen at all. We'll pick up the roughhousing tomorrow night, and if you do that tomorrow night, we'll stop again." So now the real lesson that no one understands. It happens tomorrow night. Tomorrow night occurs, and now the children have lost their roughhousing because one of them was too aggressive and not just assertive. And so this time they can do the roughhousing, and they don't put their elbow in their sister's eye because now having empathy for the sister's need not to have an elbow in her face is working in his self-interest. And whereas with mom, if she just says, you know, "Don't be too rough," and then the children know that if they are too rough, if they put the elbow back in the children's face and become the number one pinner downer, mom will repeat her warning to not do that, but will tend to let the children continue the roughhousing, but after their warning. But with the dad, the children know that they'll lose what they want if they don't consideration of someone else's feelings. Empathy does not come naturally. All children think only of themselves until it's not in their self-interest to think only of themselves, but to think of others. And so then, let's say the next night, the children, that evening, the children do not put their elbow into Susie's face. Let's say the older brother pushes the younger brother fairly hard out of the circle, and Dad says, "That I'm going to stop the roughhousing. That was too hard." "Well, Dad, wait a minute. I didn't put the elbow in somebody's face." "No, it was too hard. That amount of pushing is too hard." Now the child is learning what is aggressive and what is assertive. What's the difference? Where is the boundaries? Now, mom or dad could give the children an extensive lecture on aggressiveness versus assertiveness, but until the children experience it in real life, they don't know where that boundary is. And so the children who do roughhousing with dads, the data shows, when I did the research for the Boy Crisis book, I found that when that happens, those children are more able to be both empathetic and distinguish being assertive from aggressive, and that has enormous implications when the children go to school or have friends over, because children like children that think of them and that know the difference between being assertive versus aggressive. So these children have more friends. Children that have more friends feel better about themselves, less ashamed, less lonely, less isolated. They're more likely to feel that school is a place where they really enjoy going to because they'll have the reinforcement of good friends. And so they tend to do better in school. And they also do better in school because something else that Dad isn't explaining is that he was also requiring his children to have postponed gratification. That is, when the children were told they couldn't push each other aside like they wanted to win because they would lose their roughhousing, he was teaching them that they have to do what they need to do, that is, be considerate of others, before they get what they want, which is the more roughhousing. So he's teaching the child postpone gratification. Postpone gratification is the single biggest predictor to success, and it's the way to stop the slippery slope to the boy crisis. So, for example, when the boy has postponed gratification and he goes to school and he gets homework, so while he's doing his homework, he gets a text to do something else, he doesn't get as distracted as easily because he's learned from his father that the things he needs to do, the things that he has to do, that is, make those distinctions between being assertive and aggressive and so on, in order to get what he wants. And so he's better able to focus on the homework getting finished before he gets distracted by that text. And so those boys are far likely to do better. Therefore, they get more approval from their teacher, they get more approval from their parents, and they get more approval from their peers. And the peer group approval is especially important with grades and or doing something else like, you know, rehearsing. He has a focus as opposed to the lack of postponed gratification to practice for the basketball or football team or the soccer team. And so the girls like the guys who are either good with sports or good with, you know, a student body president or really outstanding in grades. kids. And the boy finds that, you know, when it comes to boy-girl time, the chances are fairly good that the boys don't want to date losers, they want to date winners. And so if he's not a winner, if he doesn't perform, if he doesn't have a focus, he's likely to not have the interest of girls either, which then tends to turn him to video game addiction or porn addiction. And porn addiction gets him addicted to all sorts of the dopamine in his psyche increasing, only when he has extreme sorts of excitement and stimulation from the pornography. That makes girls who actually are interested in possibly being sexual with him back off, because they feel they're treated like objects, and they are being treated like objects. And so then that turns him back to pornography, and he slips down the slippery slope into depression and then suicide, and then in the worst case, very worst case scenarios, feeling like he's not being paid attention to. He might do a mass shooting. So one time in his life, somebody says, "I wish I had thought more about Jimmy."
Wow.
That was quite an explanation.
You know, interestingly, Dr. Farrell, this is a very small part of the boy crisis, but a very high leverage remedy for parents to learn. This is in the boy crisis that we're talking about, the book written by Dr. Farrell and also John Gray. I recently heard about teenage boys carrying body pillows with them to school, photograph themselves in airports, on trains, and these pillows are called WAIFUs, W-A-I-F-U-S. Has dad deprivation contributed to a type of parenting that may rob children of life lessons through protecting them of risks, and would this be considered cruel?
Well, the fact that protection could be considered cruel is something that people do not usually associate with those two words together, as protection being a type of cruelty. But in fact, it really is. It's not intentional cruelty. Every parent who protects a child because they love him or her. They want the child not to be hurt, and the thing that they want is the child not to be subject to cruelty. But the not understanding this connection between protection being a type of cruelty is one of the other areas of the nine differences between the dad style parenting and mom style parenting. So, for example, you really see the cruelty of this happening in divorce situations, where, let's say, a dad has his children for the one weekend out of every other weekend, and it's now Sunday, and a big ball game is on, and the child wants to go to the school ground, the playground, and the father takes the son over to the playground, drops him off there, and then about 3 hours later, it's now about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the child comes home, but he's got a black eye or a scratch or, you know, some type of sign of having been in a fight. But dad has to drop the son off in 15 minutes or so. And so dad and the son barely have a chance to go over what happened at the playground. And so mom gets the child and says, you know, what happened? I see the black eye or the scratch or whatever. And the son says, well, you know, it's over. Dad dropped me off at the playground. I got into a fight with a bunch of the boys there. And that was, you know, that's what happened. You know, no big thing, but, you know, could I have, you know, some ice for the bruise? So the mother says, well, you know, why wasn't your dad there? I don't know. He was watching, I guess, the playoff game. Mom registers. Now it's pretty clear. Dad cares more about the playoff game than he does about the safety of his son. And that makes the mom feel quite justified and quite fearful of leaving the son with the dad in the future because of that conclusion. But dads have a different way of looking at that. The dad would rather have the son go over to the playground and make some assessments as to what's safe and what's not safe, and make a mistake here and there once in a while, and maybe get into a fight. And then the dad would like to have the time to be able to sort of talk with the son about, okay, what happened? Oh, nothing happened. Don't make a big thing of it. But then with hangout time, we find that when dads and kids have hangout time, do you know who Joey is from the school? He's in the ninth grade. You know, I'm only in the seventh grade. You know, and he's a big bully. So, you know, what made you realize, son, that Johnny is a big bully? Well, he was bullying somebody else around. And then we played basketball, and he was always bossing everybody, and he stuck it, you know, I was going up for a basket, and he just hit me, you know, and I sort of began to fight back with him, and he punched me, and that's how I got the black eye. Well, you know, how would you do that differently if you were, if that happened again? And it's in the process of working out with the son how he would do that differently that the dad protects the son differently. The dad begins to process with the son, like, if you see that situation again, you know, what's the red flag? What do you do when the red flag is there? Do you walk away? Do you make an excuse? When does assertiveness become aggressiveness? So that's what dads feel is helpful. Dads, as a rule, and again, roles can be reversed, as a rule, dads want children to experience real life and then to discuss with them how they can do real life better when the child has a teachable moment of being hurt. The fear of the father is sending the boy into the world protected when the world doesn't protect you. The fear of the mother is the child being unprotected at any given point in time. And so the reason children do best with checks and balance parenting is because the father and the mother, when they have both checks and balance parenting and good communication skills, they know how to hear the best intent of the other. During divorce situations, very frequently they can't hear each other's best intent. There's a lot of bad mouthing that tends to go on. Unfortunately, it's at a 5-to-1 ratio, moms to dads versus dads to moms, but even sometimes it's obviously reversed again. This type of parenting can lead to the mother saying, you know, the father doesn't care about the child in court, the child testifying to a psychologist that when she or he was with the father, they got into this fight, and then the father starts becoming much more careful with the children, and the dad-style parenting, that is dad's contribution, gets undone because the dad is afraid to do anything that doesn't protect the child, so the dad becomes an imitation mom rather than a checks and balance to the mom.
The genetic wiring of the mother assessing potential danger for the child versus the genetic wiring for the father. Is there something important to look at or examine in that area?
Yes. I mean, there's people often say, is this nature or is it nurture? And my answer is yes. And, you know, when somebody looks confused and says, what do you mean? Yes, I said either or. And I said, well, it's not either or. It's about 70% nature and about 70% nurture. And after they get over the fact that maybe I'm not just bad at math, the reason that all of those is true is because we have a part of our brain, and this is only one of the many parts, called the rostral cingulate zone. And that rostral cingulate zone responds to social, that's part of our biology, but it responds to social approval. So when somebody says, you're a wonderful parent by letting the child have the experience of going to the playground, that might be part of dad-style parenting that's genetically prone to that. But if you get approval in society for doing that, you're going to do that more often. And if you get disapproval or the court says you did that and therefore you can no longer be a dad, or very rarely a dad without supervision, let's say, then that social disapproval or that legal disapproval will be a social influence to make you lose your propensity to allow your child to do that. So, yes, fathers are much more prone to encourage children to get outside of their comfort zone, to take risks. If they go camping together, father and mother will both want the children to hike, but the mother will be much more likely to make sure that the child doesn't get too far away from the parents. The father is likely to allow more distance and even for the child to get lost on the feeling like that, okay, this is a park and the child's not going to get too lost and maybe they'll panic for a while. They'll learn things. Like when I personally was lost at John Mackey's ranch in Austin. He has a huge ranch there. He's a Whole Foods CEO. And I learned from getting lost for 6 hours before the helicopters came to find me. I I was learning all sorts of things. Like I looked at, where are the anthills being, where are they new? Where were they crushed? Therefore, where have cars been recently? If cars were here recently, then if I follow this path, maybe I'll find a way out of here. And so I picked up in those 6 hours, more about how to take care of myself if I ever should get into that situation in a way where, the person who owned the ranch wasn't rich enough to send helicopters out for me, that I could take care of myself. We are always under the influence of being more likely to be like dad-style parenting. And again, when a dad is very soft and sweet and protective, he will often seek in marriage or parenting a woman who may be tougher and stronger, and vice versa. So oftentimes opposites attract. They don't always get along well together, but they often a very strong woman. I used to work with Bella Abzug in New York, and her husband was a very soft and sweet guy, but Bella Abzug was a very strong, powerful, controlling, and almost arrogant and aggressive woman. She got along well with her husband because her husband was selected in reverse of the normal roles as somebody who knew how to just be soft, warm, and supportive.
Dr. Farrell, you've reported on a very important insight in the boy crisis that may be news to many listeners, and that's how dad-deprived boys become targets of predators, be it sexual or a tyrant. Would you elaborate on this, please?
This was surprising to me. When I did the research for the boy crisis, I saw that many people have seen the movie Spotlight, which put the spotlight on the priests in the Boston area that were predators. And most people missed the part of the movie that explained that the boys that were vulnerable, that the priests looked for consciously or unconsciously, we don't know, were boys usually that didn't have fathers. And I started seeing with Hitler Youth, there was a focus on recruiting boys that didn't have fathers because they had both with the priests and with Hitler, there was such need for direction, such need for being taken care of, being focused on, having attention of a male, that the boy was extremely vulnerable and open to direction and attention. As I said before, if a boy goes from a home to a school and the school has no male teachers, he's much more likely to be prone to not just ISIS, but gang leaders and drug dealers and other forms of authoritarian leadership. And so, and I also started seeing that when the Department of Justice did a study of boys who were in institutions where they were being taken care of by females and males, that the females were far more likely to make sexually assertive / aggressive moves on the boys that weren't asked for by the boys, that the boys later, only when interviewed, said that they didn't want, but those boys who were more likely to be vulnerable to that and not say anything were boys who were dad deprived. And so I began to see the vulnerability of boys who were dad deprived for just some sort of affection, some sort of attention, and so that they did not ask themselves about whether they felt good about being sexual in response to that attention, or whether they didn't feel good about that. And then and they certainly didn't ask themselves, am I of the age of consent to do that?
Interesting how some of the predators, as sexual predators, can detect certain inner structures of a young boy and know that there's something broken or something missing, and they become vulnerable to a situation like that.
It certainly is. I mean, we give out millions of, with our body language and the vibrations and the energy that we send forth, we reveal a lot more than we consciously reveal. And the other, I think, important thing for anyone listening to hear in terms of justice is when the Department of Justice did this study and found that so many of the female people who were supposed to be caring for the boys were actually abusing the boys, they did a very significant study on that and then did nothing about it. Unless you read The Boy Crisis, I doubt that you will have ever read about this, but you can certainly check out the original sources. But in contrast, when the priests were doing that, that we eventually didn't hear about it soon enough, but we eventually did hear about it and did prosecute the priests and did respond with outrage. And so the difference here in when males are the predators, that we do eventually, although sometimes not soon enough, do bring, you know, we punish the people who have violated our son's sexuality. And if we fail to do it, as the Catholic Church did fail to do, we begin to withdraw our approval from the Catholic Church for failing to do that. Whereas with the Department of Justice study finding that the females were the abusers, there, you know, I would be shocked if more than 1% of the readers had even heard about that study. And that gives us a sense of how much more quick we are to punish men who are violators, especially of sexuality issues, than women who are violators of sexuality issues.
Dr. Farrell, Christina Hoff Summers, author of The War Against Boys, exposed renowned feminist Carol Gilligan's research as statistically false, yet it was adopted by the U.S. Department of Education. Since the late 90s, this research has been the foundation for the projected image of females as the oppressed and males as oppressors. Would you please give listeners some examples of legislation and or policy designed to protect women, but it's based on false or poorly interpreted data and causing harm to men and women?
Well, certainly the most powerful example of that that we're all paying for in our tax money is the Violence Against Women Act, which is, you know, a huge expenditure of more than $1 billion. That is focused completely on violence against women, when in fact we have known since the 1970s. So when it comes to outside in the streets, males are far more violent to other males than women are to other women or to anybody. But when it's in domestic situations, we know that from dating years on through, that there are now more than 100 studies that have been done, most of them by women, and most of those women were feminists. And to the feminist credit, almost all the studies find some version of the same thing, which is that when it comes to domestic violence in the home, men and women are about as likely to slap each other, punch each other, hit each other with an object, stab each other with a knife, shoot each other with a gun, and kill each other, although the kill each other is far more complex a one to dissect, and I'll explain why later if you wish. But the domestic violence in the home is very much a two-way street. Almost all of the studies of domestic violence, as opposed to the crime studies, if you ask a man in a crime study, have you been subject to violence by your wife, men will answer less frequently yes. But in a study where you ask the same question of both men and women, women are more likely to say, I initiated the violence against my husband. That is, I initiated, I hit him first, I scratched him first, I punched him first, or whatever. And there's 7 levels of violence that are usually measured with the good studies. And women are more likely to initiate on each of those levels of violence. But no one knows this until they ask the men directly. And so when the first study by Strauss and Gellis came out with this in the 70s, and including asking women whether they were the ones that were the initiators, and found that more women said, yes, I was the first one to do the hitting, none of the feminists believed that. And so a number of the feminists set out to do studies asking the same types of questions or in their own style. To their credit, as I said, they pretty much all found some version of the same thing, that either domestic violence was about equal female to male and vice versa, or alternatively, it was more female to male than male to female. The important thing there is that the Violence Against Women Act does not acknowledge that. The violence, the people who are taken care of, are the women who are victims, not the men who are victims. And this actually ends up hurting women. It hurts women because, let's say you're a man and woman in the house, and you are in a big fight, and you feel the other person is dangerous to you or harmful to you, and you would like to be able to go to a domestic violence shelter rather than spend that night in the house or, you know, some type of shelter. Well, there is shelters everywhere, you know, not everywhere, but, you know, there are thousands of shelters in the United States for women, and only one or two shelters that even allow men to be able to register and get refuge there. Now, that's unfair to women. What women shouldn't have to be the ones to have to leave necessarily. There should be at least men, shelters for men and shelters to women that allow both of them to be able to escape the home for the night and until there is a ability to reconcile in a more positive type of way, until both sexes are required to go to couples communication counseling and anger management training and know how to communicate with each other in such a way helps each of them to be understood. I teach couples communication workshops all around the country, and one of the things that I know is that, you know, part of what I teach people to do is that when their partner is angry or upset, to be able to not do what we are programmed to do as human beings, which is to respond to somebody that's upset with us by arguing back with them, but rather than hearing that person out. You know, if you're my brother and you argue with me and you say, your dad always preferred you, Warren, to me, and I go, oh, he preferred you, remember the birthday party he gave for you? He never gave a birthday party to me like that. And you don't feel heard, the chances are you'll get more and more upset and maybe you'll hit me because you're not feeling heard. But if I said, oh, my God, you know, Jeff, that must have felt terrible. You must have felt really hurt and unwanted, and that probably also happened when I graduated from high school and he gave me a big party and you graduated from high school and only gave you a small party. That must have really been bothersome too. So if I'm picking up what you're saying, hearing what you're saying, and then sharing something else that even proves to a greater degree that I'm hearing what you're saying, like this not only happened in the one time that you're pointing out, but it also happened some other time, you must feel terrible about that. Well, you're not going to hit me in response to that. You're going to sort of say, wow, thank you. Probably come over and hug me and say, I just feel so, you know, cry and feel so understood. That's the response. You know, if we want to have a domestic violence prevention act and help people communicate more effectively so that being heard by their partner almost never leads to violence, not being heard by your partner can lead to violence, especially when somebody really loves you. The more you love somebody, the more vulnerable you feel. The more vulnerable you feel, the more painful their upsetness or criticism of you feels. Therefore, the more likely you are to become defensive. Anger is vulnerability's mask. And our job, if we're going to do a good job to prevent domestic violence, is to teach all of us from first and second grade on how to hear things that are critical of us, how to hear anger in such a way that helps the person who is angry understand that we feel their vulnerability and are there with them during this period of vulnerability so that they can move through it out of their vulnerability without becoming frustrated and more angry. That's what a Violence Against Women Act should be, a violence against, you know, a prevention of violence against anyone. And that should be taught both in first and second grade, and it should be available for government, with government subsidy, to every parent that wishes to enroll.
Dr. Farrell, there's a video of feminist men and women protesting at a University of Toronto event that you were speaking at, and I was wondering why there was so much anger directed at you. Would you please talk about the criticisms, rational or not, being articulated against you? It's interesting now that there isn't a men's counterpart to the feminist movement that would, for example, protest female teachers having sex with male students and shouting rapist at them.
Yes, it is really very, very sad. I think what's happened for someone that didn't pick this up from the beginning of the interview, I was on the board of directors of the National Organization for Women in New York City for a number of years and spoke all around the world as I think probably the world's leading male feminist. So I'm a very strong supporter of feminist issues in many respects. But part of we made a mistake as feminists, and one of our mistakes was that we we evolved as feminists through the civil rights movement, where there were oppressors and oppressed, and then the Marxist movement, where there were people who earned more money were oppressors, and the ones who that earned less were oppressed. And so we took that model into the feminist movement, and because men earned more, as I said before, because they were dads earned more, actually, we sort of assumed that men were the oppressors and that they made the rules to benefit men at the expense of women. And so that attitude has been with us. And so when I wrote The Myth of Male Power, and I explained really that male power is a paradox, that on the one hand, there is such a thing as male power, that is a person above you at work and does have some power over you. But on another hand, the pressure on men to have to climb the ladder to the top in order to be seen as lovable as a man, or to risk their lives in war and be disposable, you may at war risk your life more and become a general faster than a woman becomes a general. We in the women's movement said, okay, there's more generals that are men than women. This must be discrimination against women. But in fact, it was discrimination against men being expected and pressured and required to be in each generation's war. We missed completely the fact that the way we defined being a good man in every generation's war was for a manhood to be equivalent to being disposable. So the anger of feminists who assumed that there was only one way of looking at power, that it was men who had, you know, had climbed to that top of the ladder. They didn't see the powerlessness in the expectation and pressure to do that. They didn't see the powerlessness in the fact that when a man and a woman have a child, that the woman oftentimes has three options. Option one is raise children. Option two is raise money. Option three is doing some combination of both. Whereas the male who has children, he's often expected to, he has three options too. Option one is to raise money. Option two is to raise money. And option three is to raise money. And when I said things like that, it was like, no, wait a minute. This powerful group, Warren is saying, is not the oppressor. Writing books with the titles like The Myth of Male Power, the nerve of that. And so even before I did my presentation on the Boy Crisis, which was the first major presentation I did on the Boy Crisis years before the book came out, I did that at the University of Toronto. Some feminist professor read a paragraph or two from the book, and that led the Socialist Worker Party feminists in Toronto to organize against me. The Toronto campus police had to come out to stop the feminists who were giving the finger to the police and, you know, shouting in their face. But fortunately, somebody filmed that protest, and the feminists who said that, you know, that the police were treating them brutally, it was very clear that they were treating the police quite amazingly disrespectfully. And it's all one has to do is look at the video to see that the feminists were so strongly shouting down the campus police that the campus police, who are not allowed to touch the students, could not respond fully, and so they had to call the city police, who finally took the body block that the students were doing, or some of the students, the Socialist Worker Party feminists were doing, and they said that that protesting was fine, but using 50 students to prevent people from going in to hear my presentation on the Boy Crisis, that was not okay. And so the very fact that they wanted the students, the feminists, to undo the body block caused outrage among the feminists.
Dr. Farrell, you were the guest of honor speaking in Staten Island this spring about the creation of the Council on Boys and Men, addressing the many risk factors to American males. Would you please talk about that effort, and why aren't there politically powerful groups lobbying Congress on behalf of boys?
Yes, the deepest reason why there aren't a lot of groups lobbying Congress for and understanding boys is that, historically speaking and biologically speaking, we have trained boys to be disposable. And when you train a group of people to be disposable and your survival is dependent upon that, it is very difficult for you to psychologically attach and be close to those, to the children, that, to the people who are saving your life. And so that's the underlying reason. That's the biological heritage of, you know, why we don't care as much about boys and men as we do about girls and women. And also, we don't care as much about boys and men as we do about girls and women, because in order to be disposable, you have to keep your feelings to yourself. You have to do what you have to do. When the going gets tough, the tough get going. And so when people who don't express their vulnerability, who don't cry, who don't ask for help, don't get our empathy as much. And so that's the underlying reason why we don't care as much about boys and men. But fortunately, an exception to that rule happened when a fellow named James Otto was in the Cayman Islands with his wife in Staten Island. He's from Staten Island. And he read the Boy Crisis book, which is a stupid thing to do when you're on vacation. But anyway, he did it. And he wrote me saying how upset he was. But then he signed it that he was the borough president of Staten Island. And he said, is there anything I can do? And I said, yes, there's something you can do. Do you think you can persuade your fellow council people to create a Staten Island Council on Boys and Men? I am trying to create a White House Council on Boys and Men, making good progress, actually, in that area. But at any rate, so he said yes, he would check, and he said, my goodness, they do agree. And so I then flew out there and spoke with him to help create a Staten Island Council on Boys and Men, and now continuing to work with him to make that a reality. And you and I met at that presentation where I sort of gave a little bit of an overview of what the need for a council on boys and men is. And it turns out that this is the first active government entity focused on boys and men's issues, even though we have thousands of them focused on girls and women's issues.
It was a poignant moment there, like almost creating sacred space during that press conference. It was really something.
By the way, that press conference is on my YouTube channel, so if you're interested in, I felt that sacred space feeling also, and it's really a very powerful statement that you made, because there was in the room the vibration of feeling like this is an amazing thing that, A, this hasn't happened in the past, and B, we here in Staten Island are making this happen now. And that was sort of almost a spiritual feeling that I felt in the room. Is that what you were referring to also?
Definitely. People were really moved by the work of Staten Island Borough President James Otto for what he had done, and then bringing you there to speak in detail of a crisis. People know, but here it is being articulated.
Yes, I was very, very touched by that, and it's so, you know, when you write a book and you discover what you discover in writing The Boy Crisis, it's upsetting if it remains just as a book, because then it's just, you know, fine academically somebody discovered this, but to see nothing being done about it, if you have a heart, you want something done, because ultimately we all want what's best for our sons, and there's no, you know, and when a boy doesn't grow up well, that, you know, then we don't have a boy who our daughters are who are worthy of our daughters' love.
Dr. Warren Farrell, author of The Boy Crisis, Why Our Boys Are Struggling and What We Can Do About It. It's also co-authored with Dr. John Gray. This book is an invaluable compendium to lead parents, educators, politicians in the right direction toward ending the war against dad deprivation, but also revitalizing the role of men in a non-traditional job, and something we didn't get to, but providing the necessary steps to heal the ADHD epidemic. Thank you again for being on In Other News.
It's just wonderful talking to you. You do your homework so well. You ask such good questions, and you listen so carefully, and then follow up with intelligent questions with a wonderful segue. So I'd be happy to do an interview with you anytime.
Excellent. All right. Thank you again, Dr. Farrell.
You're very welcome. It's a real pleasure.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.